Our guest this week is one of the most interesting and independent figures to emerge upon the American political stage in decades. A graduate of Yale University and Yale Law School, he broke into politics back in 1970, getting elected to the Connecticut State Senate, where, as a Democrat, he served three terms as that body's majority leader. After an unsuccessful bid for Congress in 1980, he was elected as Connecticut's Attorney General in 1983, and then was elected as the state's United States Senator in 1988. He was re-elected to the U.S. Senate from Connecticut in 1994, 2000, and 2006. In the year 2000, he was also the Democratic nominee for Vice President of the United States, serving as running mate for then-Vice President Al Gore, and became the first Jewish candidate in history on a major American political party presidential ticket. We all know that Gore and his running mate lost that election to George W. Bush and Dick Cheney in one of, if not the, tightest presidential races in the history of the Republic. In the 2000 election, Gore and our guest won the popular vote by a margin of a bit more than a half million ballots, but lost the deciding electoral college to the Republican ticket 271 to 266. It was a controversial election, to say the least. Remember those hanging chads? Following 9/11, he was a supporter of George W. Bush's Iraq invasion, and one of the fascinating things about our guest is how his independence took him on a trajectory that veered toward the right and across party lines, so much so that when he ran for Senate in 2006, he lost the Democratic Party primary election, but won re-election in the general campaign as a third-party candidate under an independent party label. Actually, he never became a member of that party and remained a registered Democrat while he ran. But as you can imagine, there was no love lost between him and the Democrats. He ran for the party's nomination for president in 2004, but hardly moved the needle. By 2008, he was far more embraced by the Republicans than the Democrats, and actually made a speech at the GOP National Convention endorsing his friend John McCain for the party's nomination. He was even under consideration to be McCain's running mate on the Republican ticket before they finally settled on Sarah Palin. Half a decade has passed since this unique individual retired from the Senate, and you no longer see him as a regular player in the headlines. But let us not forget that our guest was on the short list being considered by President Trump to replace James Comey as the head of the FBI as recently as 2017. As senator, our guest introduced and championed the Don't Ask, Don't Tell Repeal Act of 2010 and legislation that led to the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. During debate on the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, as the crucial 60th vote needed to pass the legislation, our guest's opposition to the public option was critical for its removal from the resulting bill. Today, our guest works part-time as an attorney with a major law firm and a college professor in New York City. I consider him to be one of the giants of modern American politics and a man who has always sought what he perceived to be truth over victory. Here we go, an uninterrupted conversation with former United States Senator Joe Lieberman. Senator Lieberman, it is a privilege, an honor, and a pleasure to talk to you again. I don't believe we have spoken in this type of situation for about a quarter century, and the fact that you even remember me brings warmth to my heart. Thank you.
Well, I do. It's a pleasure to be with you. I remember you fondly, which we is used not to... true of everybody I've met in the media over my time. So it's good to talk to you again.
Thank you so much. For the sake of those who have not been keeping up, what the heck have you been up to the last few years? What's going on? What's going on in your life your career?
Look, the first thing to say is that I was really fortunate as a guy who, as a kid, began to dream of being in public service, particularly when I was in college. I was greatly affected by the election of President Kennedy. And I had dreams, and I really was able to live the dreams. I didn't win every election I ever ran, but I had 40 years in elective office, thanks to the people of Connecticut, 16 in Connecticut as a state senator and attorney general, and then 24 in the U.S. Senate. And so that's 40 years. And I always felt that I didn't want to, short of something beyond my control, end my life in elective office, but have another chapter. And I've been very blessed to have a great chapter. It's been 5 years now since I left the Senate. And my wife and I moved to New York because two of our four kids and five grandchildren live here. So we wanted to be close to them. We've got two other families in Baltimore and Atlanta, children's families, and that's great. And I joined a law firm half-time, but I do a lot with my other half-time. It's just my nature. I'm teaching a course at Yeshiva University, and then I used to teach one at Columbia Law. I'm on a number of nonprofit boards that work on foreign policy or education reform, or believe it or not, trying to bring a little bipartisanship back to Washington. So it's been a good life, and I get to spend more time with my wife, God bless her, and my kids and my grandkids. So that's where I've been.
That's wonderful. Now, in our accelerated society, where everything moves so quickly and everybody is tethered to each other with technology, half-time jobs, part-time jobs are more a state of mind than they are something that's measured. I find there are no part-time jobs. I find everything inflates into full-time work, no matter what it is. So my hat off to you if you're able to balance it.
Yeah, no, there is something to that. I remember when I was Attorney General of Connecticut, we introduced what we thought was a major reform. I wasn't the first to do it, but it was, you know, people could work part-time. And the first group that really took advantage of it was lawyers who had women who had children and wanted to stay home half-time. But honestly, I realized after the period of time that these lawyers were working more than half-time for the benefit of the state of Connecticut. So it is true. It really is.
Yeah, I always warn people when they say they're taking a part-time job. I said, you mean you're getting part-time pay for a full-time job? Because everything requires such constant attention these days. And
yeah,
I know you're very, very media savvy. As a matter of fact, back in the day, in the early days of the modern talk radio movement, which now is quite a mature movement, but you were very active in the early days of it, in the early 90s. You were probably, and we did research on this, the most popular political interviewee in talk radio by both liberals, now they call them progressives, there aren't that many left in the commercial end, and conservatives. So I gather you're very plugged into social media, even though I don't know whether you do it a lot, but I gather you're still very savvy about the media.
Well, you know, I probably haven't kept up enough with the trends in terms of social media. I did have a Twitter account in my last year's in the Senate, but I unfortunately let it lay low since I've left. I do some interviews now, but I must say that I always felt that doing interviews, doing media was an important part of my responsibility to my constituents, but also really an opportunity to communicate with them and get some feedback. And I believed, and still do, notwithstanding all the changes in radio. I know myself, I listen to the radio when I'm in the car. I listen to it sometime even when I'm at home. But talk radio has gone through different cycles, which you're more familiar with than I am. And yet I would find very often that people on the street would talk to me, say they heard me on such and such a radio show. More often they would say, I saw you on such and such a television show, which was fascinating. And my guess is it's still true, even though I know, and I can see it with my children, that they're much more focused on social media. They don't read newspapers that they hold in their hands. They read them online, et cetera, et cetera.
I think it's far greater than even the statistics indicate. I think that most people watch TV and listen to radio online. They think they're listening to a radio or a television, but they're really on the online broadcast of it. And newspapers, you know, anything in print. And I have the highest regard for the free press. This is my main platform is freedom of speech. I think that anything that's published on paper is becoming increasingly quaint. Isn't that funny? It's like books and newspapers.
It is true, and yet the irony here is that the public is still hungry for people who will generate reporting or opinion or conversation, as talk radio does. So even though so a number of the, as you well know, a number of the famous print outlets, print media, whose subscribership has gone down, actually are doing pretty well online because they're generating news, which has to come from somewhere. Somebody has to write it, and it's just a question of how they're delivering it. It's been a really significant change that I've seen over my lifetime. Obviously, you have too.
Yeah, with Talkers Magazine, when we stopped printing about 6 years ago and went online, it was easy because most of our constituents are media people, and we've increased our readership tenfold as a result. But what you said before is true about the typical newspapers. They do have as many readers online. Their problem has been monetizing it. It's been difficult making the transition in marketing and sales and advertising to get the same amount of bucks for space online as in print.
Right, it's interesting. I mean, at one point a while ago, after I left the Senate, I did an interview with one of the TV stations in Connecticut, and the reporter knew that I was in New York now, so I didn't get to see the station very often. So he said, well, go online. He said, actually, we have more people reading, getting our information online now than watching television at night. Fascinating, really.
Yeah, yeah. The numbers don't reveal that clearly, but those of us who have intuition and an understanding of the field can see that. Now, you used to be on the radio all the time. You were always on. When I say always, I mean you were a regular guest on my show for two exciting years back in the early 90s, leading up to and following the election of 92. And I loved having you on the show, and you were very kind and generous, and it was a great forum for you to talk to the people of Connecticut WTIC. Yep. And around the time that you were nominated for vice president in 2000, I noticed a distinct drop-off in your number of appearances in the media. Was that connected to, in terms of doing these ad hoc interviews with talk show hosts and reporters and stuff, it became a little tougher to get to you. Was that a direct result of being on the ticket?
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, I was doing a lot of media, but I think what happened is that it was happening in a different way. And I'm not complaining in what I'm about to say, but there's no question that my time was being managed by the campaign, by the Gore-Lieberman campaign. And, you know, they had priorities, which were swing states, competitive states. But I did some things that I'd never done before. I got into the habit of doing satellite tours. So you'd be somewhere and, you know, God knows where, Oshkosh, Peoria. And they'd have an hour or two allocated to just sitting down with a nice background. And you're visiting 10 or 20, basically you're having 10 or 20 3 to 5 minute interviews with TV stations all over America, not the big broadcast networks, but the local TV outlets. I would do some of the radio, but really, I did some, but as I think back to it, probably not as much as the TV, and maybe that's because the campaign was more oriented. to TV. You know, your comment is interesting. And, of course, they probably didn't – I didn't do too much in Connecticut, I bet, because they assumed, well, Connecticut was going to be all right, which it was.
Well, the feeling was, you know, and I monitor talk radio probably more than any other individual in the business, running Talkers magazine. And I had just started Talkers when you and I used to talk on WTIC. Talkers was in its first 2 years. As a matter of fact, I did that job as a supplement to my income while I was starting this business. And there was a lot of scuttle among the hosts. Most of the hosts in radio, most of whom really loved having you on. You were a wonderful guest, very articulate. You took the time to talk. They blamed the campaign. Nobody blamed you. Nobody. they thought that they blamed Gore. As a matter of fact.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was the campaign making the decisions. But I'll tell you two things. One is that. This is a story, really, but quickly.
It's interesting.
The night that it was early in August in 2000, I forget the exact date, maybe the 6th, Sunday night, I was told that Vice President Gore was going to make his selection of a running mate. And it was down to, interestingly, John Kerry, John Edwards, and me. And the next morning... it was leaked out that, and it was a fact that he had selected me. It was really thrilling. And the reason I tell you this is that they arrived at my home in New Haven, where I was, Connecticut, later morning, mid-morning maybe, the team that was going to manage my campaign. And it was fascinating. It had been put together by the Gore campaign. And they told me... later, that they were told to assemble early Monday morning. It was a Monday morning, and they weren't sure at that point whether they were going to Boston to meet up with John Kerry, to North Carolina to meet up with John Edwards, or to New Haven, Connecticut to meet up with me. But that gives you a sense of who was. That the Gore campaign really was running the campaign. It happened that I knew the woman who was going to be my campaign press secretary, Kiki Moore McLean, because I had worked with her in the Democratic Leadership Council. But most of the rest of the team I didn't know at all. They were a great team, actually, but they were in charge. I'll tell you one more talk radio story quickly. The last flash forward, it's the last 3 days of the campaign. You know, I'm Sabbath observant, so sunsets on Saturday, and I'm in Florida, and I go to Little Havana. I have a cup of that very strong and wonderful Cuban coffee, campaigning, and then I begin a classic Gore campaign tour of America through Election Day. I mean, I go across the bottom part of the country, then up to Washington State and across to Wisconsin, Minnesota, stopping at all the swing states, undetermined states, then Maine, New Hampshire. I end then I'm in Erie, Pennsylvania, western Pennsylvania. Then we fly to Tampa. I get about an hour of sleep, although I really can't sleep. And I get up at sunrise, and I meet Al Gore in Tampa, and we hold a rally. And then I fly to Connecticut to vote. And then I fly back to Nashville. And on the schedule, it says you get a couple hours sleep before the polls close. But then when I arrive in Nashville, they say to me, it's very close in some places, and we need you to be on the phone to talk radio. It was fascinating. And one of the people they put me on with, I hope I've got her name right, Randy Rhodes, is that right?
Yes.
From Palm Beach, or that area. And lo and behold, she tells me, oh, Senator, I'm so glad you called. I'm getting calls from my listeners that they went to vote. They wanted to vote for Al Gore and you. And they think they made a mistake because of the ballot.
Oh, my.
And I said, oh, my God. So I got off the phone. I called Bill Daley, who was a campaign manager, and I told him. He said, well, I just got another call about that. We're on it. We're going to check it out. And, of course, that was the beginning of the butterfly ballot hanging chads, a saga which to me was a scandal. But anyway, that was all talk radio. So they put me on that last day, and I called around the country, and Randy Rhoads told me first that something untoward was happening.
How interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
Because that went on. I mean, that is still historic in the history of presidential politics. Well, let me ask you a question without belaboring that. I understand the popular vote was about 500,000 in the favor of the Gore-Lieberman ticket. We know that Florida played a crucial role at the end, and that remains steeped in controversy, and it's kind of murky, to say the least.
Right.
How do you feel today about the Electoral College? I mean, no one other than a handful of people in the history of the United States would have so personally been impacted by the results of the Electoral College.
Well, you won't be surprised to hear, and it's not just pique or peeve, it's a principle that I think the Electoral College really is a very unfair antiquated instrument of our government, and it ought to be repealed. And it's shocking to me that after the election of 2000, and then we got 544,000 more votes than the Bush-Cheney ticket. But good glory, whatever else you say, Hillary Clinton got almost 3 million more votes than Donald Trump, than President Trump, and he gets elected because of the Electoral College. Very briefly, the Electoral College, in my opinion, and I read a lot about it, was put into the Constitution because, though the founders of our country were creating a republic that was going to be democratic, the people would govern, they were actually a little worried that the people might do something that they thought was crazy and bad for the country. So they created this Electoral College system, which at the beginning enabled essentially the elite of the state to choose the electors who would go to Washington, and regardless of who won the vote in the state, those electors could vote for whoever they wanted. Since then, many states have adopted laws that say that their electors have to vote for the ticket that got the most votes in their state. There is, incidentally, Michael, a movement, but it's a long shot. Started by, as I understand it, by basically a high-tech millionaire in California who's upset about this, and he's had a movement to get states to adopt laws that say that the electoral votes of their state will go to the ticket that got the most popular votes nationally. And I think the last I looked, there's something like 8, 9, or 10 states that actually adopted that, but they've all agreed that it wouldn't go into effect until some critical number adopted, and I think they've said 20 states. So there is a kind of quiet movement going on to do something about it. But go try to explain this to people around the world when after 2000, when I travel, our foreign leaders would come and visit me in Washington, and they would say to me, well, we don't understand. How could you and Vice President Gore get 500,000 more votes and not be able to take office? And then you have to tell the story of the Electoral College. As far as I know, we're the only country in the world that has something like this, and it's really not consistent with our national values. It ought to be repealed.
Well, I agree with you, and I find it fascinating whenever I have the argument that those who argue, and some of them are very bright, scholarly people, argue in favor of the Electoral College, I find that their argument makes no sense. But it gets so convoluted, and it becomes so, thick with statistics and facts and figures and allegations that you walk away with your head spinning. But I agree with you.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, look, the argument you hear most is more a practical political argument than a principled argument. It's a funny argument, which is the small or medium-sized states, small particularly, say, well, no candidate for president or vice president would ever come to our state if the popular vote decided. They'd spend all their time in Texas.
Which they do anyway.
Illinois and California, right? So anyway, it
has, makes no difference. It is crazy. One other thing about the Electoral College, and then I want to just cover a few other things. Obviously, I could talk to you for a year because your history is that rich, and your career and your current work touches on so many of the current issues. So I'm trying to pick and choose here and make the most of the time. I grew up at a time when there had not been in my lifetime, and I think you have the same experience, where the Electoral College actually created a winner that had a lower level of popular votes. And the feeling always was, when I was growing up, and I was very politically active even as a kid, that if ever the day comes that a candidate wins the presidency based on the Electoral College who didn't get a majority of the votes, there will be outrage. And that'll be the end of the Electoral College. And I was shocked when it didn't happen. And then it happens again, even more dramatically. Isn't it amazing how that aspect of our system just, that's it. And people are fine with it.
It is. It's like accepting. Part of it is that, for good reasons, it's hard to amend the Constitution. But you would think that this was one that everybody would agree on. I mean, after all, this is the democracy. A majority rules, and yet a majority of the people rule, and yet a majority because of the Electoral College in these two national elections in the last 20 years did not rule. And that's unfair.
So you mentioned the word earlier, restoring a sense or bringing back a sense of bipartisanship to our government. You've seen a lot of governments and you've seen a lot of changes. I guess you would agree that we're more polarized now than we have been in modern history, or is that an illusion?
Yeah, for sure. No, definitely. And it seems to get worse as we go on.
Now, you also mentioned the Democratic Leadership Council. Is that, did I get it correct?
Yes. Yes.
Weren't you involved back in the late 80s, early 90s with friends such as Bill Clinton in creating a faction within the Democratic Party to bring it more toward the center and thus be more viable so as not
I
to
was.
Create?
Yeah, I was. Yeah. To diminish my influence, but I'll just say it was actually founded after the 1984 election of President Reagan won, defeating Vice President Mondale, by a group of Democrats who felt the party was going too far left and had to go back toward the center. Clinton came on early on. I mean, Dick Gephardt was one of the founders. Vice President Gore was there. There were a bunch of others. Then Governor Chuck Robb of Virginia. And I went to the DLC in 1988 when I ran for the Senate. They helped me with some position papers that were influential with me. And then when I came to the Senate, I worked in the DLC. And then lo and behold, Bill Clinton, who I had known when he was at Yale Law, and I was a state senator early on, early 70s, believe it or not, I worked with him and renewed our friendship, and then I was an early supporter of his in 92, and those were the glory days for the DLC. I mean, he was really, I would say he was a center-left Democrat, not a left-left Democrat, and the problem today is that the center-left, let me put it another way, the left-left Democrats seem to be the dominant group in the Democratic Party, and frankly, the right-right Republicans are the dominant group in the right, in the Republican Party, and the center-right and center-left seem to have a hard time expressing the numbers that they have. And this gets me to this group called No Labels, which I'm co-chair of, which really works to encourage bipartisanship in Congress. Most significant things we've done, I think, are to create something called the No Labels Problem Solvers Caucus in the House of Representatives in Washington with 48 members, 24 Republicans, 24 Democrats, and then a similar group in the Senate called the Common Sense Coalition, led by Democrat Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Republican Susan Collins of Maine. And they're beginning to have an effect. They certainly had an effect recently on the budget problems. But it's a tough climate there. And frankly, it's one of the reasons I think President Trump was elected, in part because people just were so fed up with the status quo. And he's a businessman. He wrote the book, The Art of the Deal. They hoped maybe he'd make deals that would begin to solve some of our country's problems. And so far, that's not happened, certainly not in a bipartisan way. I hope maybe it will begin to happen before long, because right now, too many people in our country have lost confidence in our government, and that really can diminish our democracy and our future. So we better do something about it soon.
What frightens me even more than that, losing confidence in government, is losing confidence in the press. And some of the lack of confidence in the press is deserved. The media has in many ways sold out to preaching to the choir, targeting audiences for demographic and marketing benefit. Not so much political partisanship as it is corporate and marketing partisanship, which
no,
I find...
No, it's a good point. I mean, I think... that's right, that the cable news, and to some extent some on radio, look for a market niche, and it's an ideological or partisan market niche, and you can make money on it. You don't have to get everybody to listen if you just get enough, or watch, get enough people.
Right.
And it becomes an echo chamber. People go to the, including elected officials, go to the media outlets that reflect their own points of view, and it's part of why... The political parties, which used to be coalitions of very different kinds of people, now have become extremely like-minded and almost as if they were tribes, not parties, warring against each other, forgetting that we're all Americans.
And I find that the culture today encourages, not just in politics but across the board, but it's very dangerous in politics, seeking victory even at the expense of truth. This is something that I
Well, that's a good point. It's a powerful way to state it. Right. I mean, and sometimes it's victory at the expense of doing something constructive, and mm-hmm. because the victory is seen as political. At various times, people have said to me, well, gee, everybody, take the so-called dreamers, these children who were brought here when their parents came in illegally as immigrants. If you look at the polls, the great majorities in Republicans, Democrats, Independents think that these young people, so long as they haven't had criminal records, now grown up as Americans, really paid their taxes, et cetera, that they ought to be on a path to citizenship. But why doesn't the Congress get it done? Well, part of it is that people don't want to compromise, so they want to throw something else on and get something more. And I worry that sometimes people on both sides don't want to have a resolution because they'd rather run on the issue in the next election than be able to say, run on the fact that their opponents blocked something from happening, rather than saying, vote for me because I actually helped to solve this problem.
You were on President Trump's short list to replace James Comey as FBI director last year. And it's no secret that on a number of issues, you've been supportive of the president going back to the campaign. Any comments on the current state of affairs in terms of the Trump administration and the way the country is going at the present time?
Well, you know, it's such a mixed picture. I mean, you've got this natural energy and success going on within the economy now, really unemployment low, growth going on in a pretty steady way, businesses expanding. I think people are feeling better and more optimistic about the future. You have to give some credit to, I mean, I think there's a natural private sector energy that's made that happen. You have to give some credit to President Trump, both for deregulation, some of which I support, some of which I oppose, and also probably in the short run or near term for the tax cut bill, even though I think in the long term it creates a terrible problem with the growth in the national deficit. But the president himself is unlike any president we've ever had. I keep trying to separate out his personal tweeting and name calling of other people from his record. It's hard to do because the way a president acts is part of his presidency. So I would say, you know, on some things in foreign policy, particularly, I agree with him, and really most of what he's done domestically, I disagree with. And I wish most of all that he'd use that skill as a negotiator and deal maker to bring members of both parties together to solve some of America's problems and seize some of our opportunities. And so far, I haven't seen that happen as I'd like it to.
And there you have it, an uninterrupted conversation with former United States Senator and Democratic Party candidate for Vice President of the United States in 2000, Joe Lieberman.